All right, we had two items that we were going to discuss a little further, as I recall. And one of those was whether sacrifices could be made anywhere other than at the tabernacle slash temple by anybody other than the priests. And the other one was, does high places mean elevated, or does it mean lofty in the way of, what would you call it, religious value, spiritual value? So let's look at those. I think we can knock out the sacrifices one little more quickly. If we, I just looked up the word sacrifice in the Old Testament, and I didn't find anything just using the word sacrifice in the Old Testament, in the American Standard Version, of which there's 161 matches for the word sacrifice. That have to do with any sort of personal sacrifices. In other words, that people, you know, did it themselves, you know, by their house or out in the field somewhere. I'm just almost positive that I've seen that, and maybe if I expanded that to looking up the word sacrifices, it might do that. It might show something, though I'm thinking it's in the later divided kingdom area where that occurred. So let me turn my phone off here. So anyway, if we look at these 161 instances here, of course the first one in Genesis talks about Jacob offering a sacrifice on the mountain, but that was before anything official was established. And then the next time that we see anything is when Moses is explaining to Pharaoh that they want to go and do sacrifices. I think that's the that's what it is in 5 and several times. Let's go sacrifice to Jehovah. And it's not until, what is it, chapter 10, 11, that they start to leave. So all of these have to do with, we'll go in the wilderness and sacrifice to God, okay, and so on. and then we do see that in the institution of the Passover, what was the Passover? Why do we call it Passover? Yeah, the angel of death. Yeah. Okay. All right. So that's where Passover comes from. It is literally that the angel of death passed over. It might. You what? Yeah, I do. But let's see if I just put. I hate this one. It does that. Stop it. Yeah. I'm just going to. Expand it to sacrifice with any ending. Now we went to 200, so we got another 100 things, but we have to look down into what we were looking for is that the question came up. It said that Solomon went up to Gibeah and offered sacrifices. Now, of course, we realize that this is used in sort of the royal we type thing. But the question then came up based on that. We couldn't just make sacrifices anywhere, could we? We had to do it at the temple or the tabernacle. And so I think we saw sacrifices made in Jerusalem, right? I think that's what may have brought this up. I know that Solomon went up there and did that stuff in Gibeah because that's where the tabernacle was. Even though the Ark of the Covenant was down there in a tent, a tabernacle, but not the tabernacle with a capital T, in Jerusalem. but that wasn't the tabernacle that God had caused to be set up. So anyway, that's what it was. I thought for sure that I had seen something within the Old Testament in this particular area where people did lawful sacrifices to God somewhere other than in the area of the tabernacle. I want to say there was something to do with Gideon or with Samson or something like that. So that would have been earlier. but I'm having a hard time finding that. But the thing is that when we look just through the word sacrifice, we see that really the people were to offer a sacrifice, and it says when you offer a sacrifice. But the thing is, they were to bring it to the priest. They were to lay their hands on the offering, and the priest would then kill it and make the offering in the tabernacle / temple, whichever was in existence at the time. Now we see here, just as an aside here, when we're talking about the discussion between Samuel and Saul, where Saul decides that he's going to offer the sacrifices himself, we note that here in 1 Samuel 10:8 is where Samuel tells Saul to go down to Gilgal. Now, where's Gilgal? Down by the river, right? That's where they crossed the Jordan to begin with. So it's a little bit to the south of Jericho and right on the river. And so Samson says, go down to Gilgal and I'll come to thee and offer burnt offerings. Samuel will, right. So he's a priest, yes, we discussed that. But obviously, it's not at the area where the tabernacle is. It's down in Gilgal. Tabernacle's in Gibeah. So, or Shiloh or something like that. But anyway, it's in that area up there. so we do see an instance here where a sacrifice was to be made in a place that was not associated with the tabernacle. But we still don't see anything right yet. And I haven't been able to find anything that indicates that individuals made sacrifices themselves without the assistance of a priest at a place other than the tabernacle. So, anyway, let's continue to look that up. After having gone through and looked briefly at the 161 matches that came up first and not finding anything, now that I put this one with the ending on it so that it gives us sacrifices and sacrificed, we got 261, and of course I didn't think of burnt offerings, or somebody else said something else, I think. Carolyn. No. All right. Yeah. Apparently, I got to type it right in order to make it work. My thought there, my first impression is, without studying it more thoroughly, but as I recall when we were studying in this area, it is that these people were idol worshippers to begin with. Samson and his Samson, right? Yeah, Samson and his family. They were nominally good Jews, but they were. I believe that isn't this where we talk also about the fact that they took the house idols and did something with them? And am I mixing this up with Gideon? Maybe I am. Yeah. Right, right. She brought the house gods with her. And as a matter of fact, yeah, right. So there's things, the thing is that it appears like sort of the official worship hasn't actually been set up. I mean, They went and put the tabernacle up in Shiloh, Gibeah, whatever it is, wherever it is. And it kind of sits there. And, you know, we see a story about Eli, and we see stories about Samuel and such alike as that. But it seems to me that it's not particularly formal, even though we do see, when we see the story of Samuel, that we do see that it was apparently that the people went there to the tabernacle to make their sacrifices, because Elkanah and her husband, what's his name? Yeah, what? Hannah is the wife. Yeah, Hannah and Elkanah went up to this area to make their yearly sacrifices, and the priests took care of them, as it were. Maybe that's the kind of things that I was thinking of, is that when they were, yeah, right. So, anyway, I think we can come to the conclusion that the vast majority of instances in the Old Testament seem to indicate that sacrifices are to be made at the tabernacle or the temple using the offices of the priest. I'm sure if we looked into the captivity books that we would find that other things were done. And perhaps after they came back from Babylonian captivity, there might be something that we might see there that indicates that there was sort of a change in things, because they were in the process for a number of years of rebuilding the temple. But I'm trying to think of what any of the post-captivity books, whether they talk anything about, you know, day-to-day lives and making sacrifices and things to that. So, okay. So if we talk sacrifices to death for now, we'll just keep studying that and see if we can't come up with some conclusive answer. Anyway, I wanted to move on to high places. And maybe this won't take as long because I was able to study it out a little bit more. But so I looked up the occurrences of the word high plus places, or high plus place with an asterisk after it. I mean, it's going to get me place and places, so it'll get singular and plural. And I found 52, something like that. 232 matches to those. And doing that, I was able, for example, here I just looked up Proverbs 8:2, because as it turns out, there appear to be at least two words that end up being translated high place or high places. And this area in Proverbs is one of the areas in which it's not the other word. So that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But anyway, so this word here in Proverbs 8:2 comes from the Hebrew word marom. And in Strong's sort of abbreviated definition, it talks about from another word, Old Testament 73:11, which is another word. It talks about altitude, or concretely an elevated place, but abstractly elevation, figuratively elation, or adverbially aloft. So as we look at these, and this is Old Testament 47:91. If we look through those, all the occurrences of that particular Hebrew word, as we look down, we see it talks about things like from above and on high and the height, and once again on high. But later on down, I think this is the word, but we'll also see in the Hebrew that it's also translated dignity. Let me see. Let me get down here. There it is. So here in Ecclesiastes, for example, it says in great dignity. So there's a certain spiritual, you might say, nature to the thought of this word. But the vast majority of this word that's in sort of in the minority, as far as the number of words goes, is used to indicate some sort of elevation. And so if we look at a more expanded definition, this is Vine's Old Testament definitions. This word, marom, it says, appears about 54 times in biblical Hebrew. And curiously enough, my number there says 54 matches, which kind of worked out fairly well. He defines it, Vine does, as higher plane height, but also high social position. And actually, there's a city in Israel called Marom, also, apparently meaning high. First biblical occurrence is way off in Judges, a higher plane on the surface of the earth. Isaiah 33:5 and Job 16 contains the word with the meaning of the height as the abode of God. I'm thinking that that's more of a essentially a physical thing. They're talking about God being higher, but also we could look at it as in a spiritual nature also, talking about, as he says, a higher plane. Now, the other word that's used is this 11:16, which is the word bama. That's used much more frequently. Notice that it says that this particular word occurs 102 times in the Old Testament, and it occurs, as he says, in other Semitic languages. Now, it talks about the back of an animal, the back of a mountain in Akkadian, or a block of stone, or, as he says here, the grave of a saint in Arabic. So it's first used in Leviticus 26:30, and that's where, if you run through the words high in place, you'll find the first instance occurs is in Leviticus. When we're talking about this word, yeah, it occurs in Leviticus. And that's where God says, I'll destroy your high places and cut down your images and cast your carcasses upon the carcasses of your idols, and my soul shall abhor you. So this is where, in Chronicles here, is where Moses is bringing the law to the people. And at the beginning of chapter 31 of 2 Chronicles, he's talking about the blessings that they'll get. And once again, then it talks about the curses if they fail to do this, follow the things that they were doing. That's 2 Chronicles. No, excuse me. It's another place. It talks. Moses isn't in 2 Chronicles very often. I was thinking about this reference where it says Leviticus right here, Leviticus 26:30. That's where Moses is bringing the law to the people, and he talks about the blessings and the curses. But the thing is that it appears that the word bama has much more of an idea of physical height. As we look in, of course, you can all turn to this in your commentary of the Pentateuch by Kylan Dolitzik, which I'm sure you all have. In their discussion of this area, let me see if I can find it, says, the high places are altars erected upon heights and mountains in the land upon which sacrifices were offered both to Jehovah in an unlawful way and also to heathen deities. Sun pillars, which is part of the quotation that's featured there in Leviticus, are idols of the Canaanitish nature worship, either simple pillars dedicated to Baal or idolatrous statues of the sun god. As Kyle and Dolitzik say in their commentary, they imply, without just coming right out and saying it, that it appears to be more an elevation thing as opposed to a spiritual thing. Of course, they all end up being spiritual things anyway, because either they're offering these sacrifices to God at these high places or they're offering to idols at these high places. So neither one of them is what God specified. So that's something that we have to be careful about when we look at this, is that is that it says in the context in which we're in right now in 1 Kings about chapter 4, that it says the people still worshiped at the high places. Now, as Mickey had mentioned, he doesn't think that this is an indication that Solomon and the people went off in idolatrous worship immediately, but rather they didn't have a place to worship that was for them convenient. And when we get to the divided kingdom, what did Jeroboam do? I always get them mixed up. Jeroboam was not in Jerusalem, right? And Rehoboam was. So what did Jeroboam do? He set up Samaria, and he also put idols in Dan and Gilgal, or not Gilgal, somewhere down fairly close to Jerusalem. And why was that? So the people wouldn't be tempted to go to Jerusalem to make their sacrifices, that it would be more convenient for them to go to one of these other places. So that's what Jeroboam did, and so that's what the people started doing. And yes, he set up the hill of Samaria to be sort of the place of worship for the people at that time. And they instantly went off into idolatry. Of course, they're probably a good ways on their way toward it anyway, especially given the fact that the latter part of the reign of Solomon seemed to be not a particularly godly one. Okay. Any other thoughts or questions about high places? So high places are look like what they're, what we're looking at here is elevated places. So once a, what? Yeah, Strong's. Right. So for those of you that are not aware, Strong, when he set up his concordance back in the, you know, a gazillion years ago, whenever he did that, he assigned numbers to all the Hebrew and Greek words. And so now it's a very common occurrence then to have books that talk about the Hebrew or Greek languages of the Bible to reference Strong's numbers. So we'll say Strong 1116 or Strong 4517, you know, in the Hebrew, or Strong some other number in the Greek. And that's something that's worth your knowing. You'll hear people refer to, you know, Strong's numbers all the time. Okay. Once again, as I've done before, I just wanted us to, once again, if this will work, be aware of where we are and what we're looking at, because this is a class about the history and geography of the Bible lands. Of course, nothing's going to work for me anymore, and it's all terrible. Okay, so it hates me. So I guess we didn't want to do that. But you'll be happy to know that we're an eye altitude of 684 feet, wherever we are. Let me see if I zoom over to Bible land. There we go. It left us. And now we're going to go across the world to the Bible lands area. And you'll remember that the area that we're talking about, which apparently in the real world is very blurry. There we go. you know, it's just a really small area. I mean, here we have the country of Egypt that comes about over to here and down here even further. So that's the whole country of Egypt. It's relatively large. But if we look at the country of Israel, it only goes from the south end of the Dead Sea up to the top of the Sea of Galilee up there. A very small little piece, a very narrow piece of land. The thing is that why geographically is this such an important place? Trade routes. And why do the trade routes go there? the geography of the land. Remember when we talked earlier, let me pull this map down a little bit so I can point at it, because I don't have my pointer out. remember that this area right here was all what? Lava fields, okay? And this area all here is what? Sand. You know, there's what? Not friendly. Yeah, it's kind of like here. So the thing is that when you look at this area, if you want to get over here to the rest of the Persian Gulf area, which, let me back out a little bit, all right, and we look at little tiny Israel over here and say, well, if I want to go over here, how am I going to get there? Well, you simply can't go this way. At least you couldn't back then. Today, I guess we could take our helicopter or take our car across some road that might be out there. But there's just no way to get to the other part of the world without going through Israel. What is this particular area here called? The Fertile Crescent. Randy, you had a comment? Yeah, sure. Right, but nobody does. So, yeah, right. So, yeah, if you can go from Africa to Europe or Asia, here's where you go on foot. Take a boat, I suppose, but that's a fur piece across there on a boat. We see what happens to people occasionally when that happens if we look at the trips of Paul. Or the trip of Paul, I should say. And is there a laser in this thing? So, nope. Yep. Nope. All right. So the reason this is so important is because there's trade routes, and the trade routes are very narrow as far as, or close together, I should say. There's the coastal route, and then there's the middle route, which is called something else. The middle route. What? Way of Shur. Yeah, of course. Shur. And then the King's Way, right? The King's Highway up here is sort of up on the cliffs above. These are all cliffs here. But once you get any further this way, you're in the dunes. You know, you're in the real bad desert. So it's a choke point. And, of course, even within Israel itself, there is another major choke point, which is what? Megiddo, which is right here. We have this area right here, which what that prominence that comes out, what's it associated with? Mount Carmel. Okay. So about where the hand is about where Mount Carmel is, a little bit to the west. Or into the valleys, right? So, yeah, you have to. It's very narrow. You can see right here that the mountainous area goes right about down to the sea, you know. And so then there's another valley right here. I don't know if you can see it. You can see the road going through here. But you note that there's hills, mountains, whatever they are. There's only one road going through here. It's a choke point. And that's where the people of Israel, the kings of Israel, would set up fortresses and things like that. This was the place to really reinforce things to make sure that people wouldn't get to you from the north. Now, of course, Pharaoh could come up from the south and do whatever he wanted. But they had a lot of desert to cross just to get there. And, of course, you know, they had their weather balloons and, you know, biplanes and everything to... Right. So in the area that we're studying right now with Solomon, what do we see that happened? That's right. Solomon was the man. And so he had the land from down here at the Brook of Egypt in this area somewhere, all the way up there to the to the Euphrates River. And so he had, I guess that's Euphrates there. Now, so he had control of this area. Now, that's not to say that they inhabited this area. Remember, you'll look, as we look in our book, it'll have a colored area. It says the area where most of Israel lived. And yes, that was between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea, off to the west a little bit. But they had control of this area. So in Saul's time, they had nominal control of some of this area. But we noticed that we had difficulty with the Philistines quite a bit. Then in David's time, you see that they were battling quite a bit. But it says that David recovered the lands up to the river Euphrates. Now, I think we probably should note that I don't think there are a whole lot of people between the top of the Sea of Galilee and the Euphrates River. I mean, it's part of the Fertile Crescent, it's still a little bit far inland to really partake. When we look at the Fertile Crescent, it comes along the sea here and then comes around and becomes greater as it comes over to the Persian Gulf area. So this is a much more watered area over here in Iran. I think that's is it Iraq, then Afghanistan, then Iran, I think. So over here it's much more watered, even though it's still pretty desolate, I guess. Yeah, I don't think that we've seen a whole lot of climate change there. We did see some in the history of Egypt that's actually in biblical history, that it talks about a few places here and there that aren't really there anymore because desertification happened. The Nile sort of dried up in a few areas here and there. I don't know that from that time to this time we see any large climate changes, but there certainly are identifiable global climate changes in that area in biblical history going way back. Yeah. All right. So what happens if we go back here? Anyway, just wanted to impress upon you how far away it is, okay? And I mean, if you watch that globe go by, you see that we've essentially gone halfway around the world, right? Oh, you see the parking lot now has the solar collectors, solar panels over there at the school building. So as we zoom out and go around, you see that we've got quite a ways to go to get to the biblical lands. But they're so important. It's every time I look at a map like this, I think, "Wow!" I mean, it sort of goes without saying, God knew what He was doing. So when He created the world, He made a place that was the place where people at that time would want to be. You know, so now of course people want to be here where Yosemite is and all that sort of stuff, but. Still, it was a nice place to be. It was had a great place for raising crops and raising your family and such like as that. So, it's interesting to see how all this developed. All right, any further commentary on our world trek here? Let's go and finish looking at these questions. Okay, remember that we sort of corrected this and said that Solomon became king in about 960-ish, 61 or something like that. Apparently that's a typographical error. remember that when we talk about Solomon's reign, which lasted for how long? 40 years, as opposed to David's reign, which lasted for 40, as opposed to Saul's reign, which lasted for 40 years. Okay, so each of them lasted for 40 years. Which, according to my calculation, is about 120 years that they had the kings in the United Kingdom. Yeah, I did that without a calculator. I can tell you're impressed. Anyway, here we see that the land was at rest for 40 years. We see that in Saul's time, they were still having a lot of battles, and they're not having a whole lot of luck holding the Philistines back and the other people from the other side of the river and such like as that. So they're having a lot of trouble. During David's time, he was doing a pretty good job of holding his own and taking some more stuff. But by the time we get to Solomon, then we've got sort of 40 years of rest. Now, once we get into the discussion about the temple, how long did it take to build the temple? 7 years. And how long did it take to build Solomon's palace? 13 years. So 7 plus 13 is, carry the 9, divide by 3 is 20. Yeah. So 20, you got that right away, didn't you? Yeah. So about 20 years, which is half of Solomon's reign. He was busy building things. And then I think the book, the lesson book, which I don't have with me right now. Do what? Yeah, yeah, I think he built houses for a lot of daughters that weren't his. Yeah. But we also see who supposedly wrote the book of Ecclesiastes? Solomon. And we see all the things that he talks about in there. He doesn't talk about going out to war. He talks about gardens, and he talks about neat places, and essentially what he talks about is the good life, and then talks about how a lot of it is vanity and a striving after wind. But so Solomon had reason, I guess, to write things like that, because I think he realized that he was sort of living as the privileged class, and perhaps had some idea that really what the life that he was living was not the ideal life. Remember in question 3, we talked about the fact that Solomon went up to Gibeah to talk to God about his request, that God granted him what? Wisdom and, pardon? Riches and something else, honor, and then what was conditional? Longevity was conditional, yeah. So as we look at that, we realize that he did promise him all those things, but at least the longevity part was incumbent upon him following God's will. And did he have a long life? No. Not according to them, and certainly not according to us, did he have a long life. All right. If he obeyed faithfully the word of God, question 5. Okay. All right. So Solomon started building the temple in the 4th year of his reign. How many years had passed up to that point since the Israelites had come out of Egypt? That's what they got too. So 480 years after they had left Egypt, Solomon starts building the temple. So remember that we've got 120 years of span here of the kings of the United Kingdom. So Solomon starts building the temple 480 years after, so 380 years and another 20 years is 360 years. So even before the reigns of the kings started, they'd still been in the land of Israel 360 years or 350 years, something like that. They had been there in Israel as God's nation for significantly longer than the United States has been around. And the United States, in case you don't know, has the longest single form of government in the history of the world. So you might say, well, what about Great Britain? Well, no, they've changed their government several times, the way that they do things. So, but in our 200 and whatever years that we've been around, our government structure has been the same constitution and all that sort of stuff. So, and we look at that and we say, well, they were around already twice as long as the United States has been here. So it's one thing that I notice as we study through the Bible, is the great expanses of time that we're talking about here in many cases. But how the people are aware of the things. I mean, how much do we think about the second president of the United States, whoever he might have been, John Adams. There you go. These folks knew everybody. I mean, you know, all the way from the first judge on up and all that. It was just part of their history. It was part of what they did. You know, of course, they had all these record written down to remind them and all. And they were told that they were to read this and study it and such a like as that. And of course, we're told to read and study American history, and of course, we don't. So, all right. So Solomon had 10,000 of his 30,000 men. This is during getting ready to build the temple. Solomon had 10,000 of his 30,000 men working in what mountain range? The Lebanon Mountains. Okay, and how did he rotate this about? Monthly. Okay, he had 10,000 folk out there working 1 month. And they had 2 months off. Well, the next 10,000 took over. And then they had 2 months off after that, and so on. Yes? Yes. Yeah, I think so. Not only did he have these 30,000 people, but do we have that in the question? Out in the forests, yeah. But he had another, 60,000 or something like that that were put to tasks. So there were, as we read throughout the Old Testament of the United Kingdom and actually from Joshua and going in, we see that a lot of the folks that were there were put to task. In other words, they became slaves. And so burden bearers. All that. Yep, that's what they were told would happen to them. So there were a lot of people, but yes. And you know, one of the things that I note about when David, toward the end of his life, sent Joab out to number the people, why do we think, besides the fact that God didn't tell him, that this was such an egregious sin or hardship upon the people? What was the purpose of numbering the people? Taxation and the draft. So when they came out and said, I'm with the Census Bureau, how many people you got in your house, that was to find out how many people they could draft and what they were going to levy as taxes. And so that's why the people hated being numbered and probably why Joab hesitated, as it were, to go out and do this task. It's because that was generally the purpose. Even when God caused the people to be numbered, that's why he did it. So that he would know how many people, the king or the judge or whatever, would know how many people to raise for the army. Yes, the fighting men, right. So which were essentially between 20 and 60, right? So, I think. That's why they didn't like that. And they had a whole lot more than just these 30,000 men working. Of course, Hiram had his folks working too. They were the experienced woodcutters. And so Hiram had his people out there. And they were the ones that knew what to do. And then the other 10,000 at a time just were the sort of burden carriers type thing. What did they do with all this lumber? Well, yes, they did. Before they started building the temple, they what? Yeah. Well, it was a bigger river. It was a Mediterranean river. Yeah. So Hiram caused all the lumber to be brought down and made into rafts at the Mediterranean, and then they floated it down to where they could more conveniently hike over the mountains with it on their backs. So I don't know, they brought Hannibal with his elephants or what, but they had to haul it from the sea up to Jerusalem. So that was a bit of work there too, Jerusalem being at about 2,500 feet and the Mediterranean being at sea level. Yeah. So yes. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think they could have done it on the Jordan River because it gets so shallow in places and has so many rapids. And it would probably be just, it would probably be much harder for them to get it from the forest down that side of the escarpment, as it were, to go down to the river. I mean, then now you're ending up below sea level. So now you got to get up to 2,500 feet and you're 1,300 feet below sea level. So it makes your work even harder, I guess. So, all right, how long it take to build the temple? We already talked about that. After 7 years of work on the temple, Solomon spent 13 years building what? His house. Who marveled at the beauty, and we haven't gotten to this yet in the reading, who marveled at the beauty of Solomon's kingdom and declared, the half was not told me? Queen of Sheba. Okay. Now, let's go back to the map again here. Looks like we're out of time. But Sheba, according to what I've been told, is down here in the area of Oman and places of Ethiopia and such alike as that, down here at the sort of at the tip of, I think this is, where is all the pirates are in Somalia, right? They're right about here. And Oman, I think, is on the edge right here somewhere. So the Queen of Sheba would have been way down here. So she had a good long ways to go. A fur piece. That's right, as they say in California. So anyway, a long way to go. And here's Israel way up here, and all you can see here is the Dead Sea. It's so small. So she had a long way to go. All right, we'll finish off the questions next time and start actually talking about more of Solomon's reign.